Actually, I think less people would be annoyed if they suggested we're putting the pennies in the GPO.
As it became apparent that he was going to win the yellow jersey, he just went, oh, like that. The tears are falling from my eyes as I think about the nostalgia.
Thinking about Charlie Harvey.
Yeah. Now, there was a fella. Complicated.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to A Few Scoops, the news podcast that's trying to get everyone to listen to the news but be slightly less depressed. And I'm here once again with the Grand Marshal of A Few Scoops on the week of the glorious 12th, Kyle Morrigan.
I walked all the way here and...
from Mogashal, did you?
Exactly. Nobody would stop me from my God-given right to walk through the Liberties, as it turned out.
His own Garvahi Road. So we'll start with the glorious 12th of July celebrations that are held in the north. Not only in the north, they hold one in Donegal. They hold one in Benidorm, if you can believe it.
People are orange there for a different reason.
Yeah, lots of orange people there. So over the weekend, there has been a number of controversies, which, you know, as someone from the north, this happens every year. But I feel that it's getting more dangerous when it comes to how the 12th is celebrated, notwithstanding the fact that the Orange Order has been grounded in anti-Catholic beliefs since its inception and still holds those beliefs. I actually read this morning that even if you're married to a Catholic and you yourself are a Protestant, you can't join the Orange Order. So there you are.
Maybe they just don't want to cause any tensions within marriages. Is that possible?
That's what they don't like divorce either, I would say. So this weekend, the PSNI, the police service in the north, refused to help Belfast City Council dismantle a loyalist bonfire that they believe posed a risk to public health and energy. Off Donegal Road, this bonfire is on a site believed to contain asbestos, and it is close to an electricity substation that powers two of the hospitals, two of the main hospitals in Belfast. During the week, the City Council committee voted to send contractors to dismantle the bonfire and ask the police to help them, which created a dilemma. Now, that is not the words I would use. This is written by The Guardian. Created a dilemma for police. Because paramilitary groups warned of widespread disorder if the pyre was removed. Pat Sheehan, the Sinn Féin MLA for the area, said that this was basically mob rule. I don't believe this is a dilemma for the police. Two of these bonfires are being investigated as hate crimes, and this threatened a substation for two hospitals. And the police said they had a dilemma. They didn't know what to do. And then the police said on Thursday they decided not to intervene after they consulted the Northern Ireland Environment Agency, Electrical Utility Fire and Rescue Service, Belfast Health and Social Care Trust and Belfast City Council. They said after speaking to all these stakeholders and an evidence-based assessment, they said that they would not be associated with the removal.
So do you think an evidence-based assessment would be them saying, right, what's the worst that could happen? The substation is broken. How soon can power be put back on versus a load of rioting? Like,
rioting that could go on for a number of days.
Yeah, which could burn other substations.
The thing about a riot is that they catch on pretty quick. So if one happens in one part of West or East or North Belfast, another one will start pretty quickly.
Yeah, I know you've no sympathy for them. I kind of like, if they're doing the sums and the calculus of it and trying to figure out like a threat, like obviously the time to fix this was 10 years ago and not let the bonfires become, you know, so big or to get...
So for just people who aren't overly aware of how it works in the north, these bonfires haven't always been this big. There used to be a lot more bonfires, but they were smaller. But because they're trying to kind of, pardon the pun, extinguish the amount of bonfires, the bonfires tend to be more separate, but they are bigger. And even in nationalist communities, so when I was younger, and this is the thing, people, there's a lot of classism when people talk about bonfires. It's seen as something that working class communities do on both sides of the debate. And I would always say to people, I used to go to bonfires. So I used to go to the bonfire in the Bogside in August. Nationalists have theirs in August.
It's the middle of August. Is it around the time of the Feast of the Assumption, Our Lady?
Yeah, so I would go in a Celtic top and drink a load of cans and lose a couple eyelashes and try and get a kiss. That was, you know, the height of it. But with the bonfires I would be at, you know, there'd be DUP election posters on it and Union Jacks. And you will see bonfires in loyalist areas will be covered in tricolours, Palestine flags. But this year we saw an even greater display of hatred. And for once, it wasn't actually sectarian hatred. Yeah. It was a life-size replica of a small boat that migrants would use to cross the English Channel. Then underneath that, they had a banner that said veterans before refugees. Now, this is being investigated as a hate crime because it was later set on fire.
And that must be one of the most planned in that you have to go out and get
the mannequins are like life-size. So
life-size and dark grey mannequins from the shops. Then you have to buy the life jackets, vests.
Yeah.
And you have to, and a boat.
And a boat.
And you have to get it on top of the whole thing.
Yeah. So this bonfire, this particular bonfire, was in Moygashel in County Tyrone. It's a small wee village.
Where is Moygashel? Where would you be passing it through it on the way from anywhere to anywhere?
It's outside Dungannon. So Dungannon would be a relatively big town in Tyrone. But it is, it's quite rural. It's in Fermanagh and South Tyrone Council.
And land. Would it have always been a place for that kind of thing?
I had never heard of Moygashel before this summer. And this particular boat, this replica, has been completely overwhelmingly criticised. So the head of the Church of Ireland, Sinn Féin, a number of prominent politicians, Amnesty International, have said, you know, that it's horrific. Then other bonfires will say things like KAT. So for people not from the north, KAT means kill all Tags. Tags is a derogatory term for a Catholic, sort of like a Fenian.
But KAT, kill all Tags, targeting a specific group based on their religion, is nowhere as bad as a guy on stage at Glastonbury shouting death to the IDF, which is an army currently involved in a war in Gaza. I mean, I can't say that for definite, but because Keir Starmer didn't mention...
Yeah, so Una Mullally, who, to be honest, Una Mullally from the Irish Times rarely misses, and Una Mullally had a very interesting column this week about how Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, had a lot to say about kneecap at Glastonbury, has said nothing about the bonfires, has said nothing about the effigy of refugees being burnt on top of a bonfire, has said nothing about kill all Tags. And it's almost as if, you know, certain things are seen as acceptable because what you tolerate is what you accept. I absolutely believe if you are from the North or Northern Ireland, as they would call it, and you believe you are British, then you are British. Accepting someone else's Britishness does not take away any of my Irishness. But I do not believe on either side we should be having bonfires in this day and age. They are dangerous. They're bad for the environment. They promote sectarian hatred, whatever you think about it. Now, when I was 14 and 15 and going to a bonfire, I wasn't sitting around thinking about how much I hated Protestants. But it seeps in.
We don't generally rely on 14 and 15-year-olds to be thought leaders
exactly.
for their community. Like, you're operating within the... There's a bonfire there.
And make no mistake about it. The DUP have said that people should go out and enjoy the 12th. Emma Little-Pengally, the Deputy First Minister, said that obviously threats of violence are never acceptable, but the people were playing politics. I do not think a fire in an asbestos-laden site near two of the main hospitals in the biggest city in the north is playing politics.
There's a nice nostalgia that asbestos takes us back to the past as well.
It's doesn't kind of it?
A, yeah. What about, bullshit argument alert, this is cultural expression. The bonfires are works of culture, works of artistic expression. Writing things about death to people on top of them is just a form of extreme provocative art, performance art, just like kneecap with the kill your local MP.
Yeah, that, so there had been a number of very, very weak arguments put out on the social media app where you thought they would be put out on, including from a number of, you know, loyalist representatives saying that this was their culture. It's no different from what kneecap did and, you know, they should be allowed to do it. I think that's absolute nonsense. I don't think that burning an effigy of refugees, an already vulnerable and highly susceptible to violence and violent attacks population, is in any way the same as kneecap talking about Palestine or Bob Villain calling for the death to the IDF as a war machine. And I absolutely believe if you want to go to the 12th and listen to the flute bands and have a barbecue, I think you should be, that is cultural expression. Absolutely. I'm not saying it's not their culture. It is. In 2025, everything we know about bonfires, someone died falling off one of these bonfires a number of years ago. And they're getting bigger. They're putting more people, residential houses in danger, hospitals now in danger. It's dangerous for the children, and it is children who are helping build these bonfires. And if it is the case that they want to have a bonfire, surely there's a way they could take it out to a more rural area put buses on. Like, people get bussed in for the 12th and they want to enjoy the music or whatever. But this and the effigy. You know, we'd had effigies of politicians before. They used to, you would have burnt, like, people would have burnt, you know, an effigy of, I don't know, Naomi Long, the Justice Minister, or Michelle O'Neill. And obviously people said it was disgusting. But that is also a public figure who is quite used to and has their own security. Refugees are an incredibly vulnerable population. And we saw riots in Belfast not that long ago where people who were not born or thought to be not born in the north were burnt out of their houses and their shops. So I think it is repulsive. I think all decent, ordinary people, no matter what their religion, would be repulsed by it. And I actually think it's dangerous for the people involved in building the bonfires as well. So happy 12th of July, Colm.
I must go up there sometime. What did you do for the 12th?
I went to Donegal like all the rest of the people from the nationalist background.
You walking cliche. Well, I mean, the good news is that the Waterworld in Bundoran opened just in time.
It opened
on Friday the 11th of July. They revamped their viewing area. By the way, Waterworld is a fun park, not a post-apocalyptic water-covered planet starring Kevin Costner.
Bundoran,
in this case,
known to the locals as Fundoran.
Very good.
And yeah, Waterworld opened on the 11th. It's like they could smell the Belfast and Derry nationalists just teeming into their beautiful county.
Shafties, apparently. Belfast people, it's...
You said that to me, but I'm...
Yeah, I saw somewhere one of the nicknames for them.
Text or email, and if you've ever heard a Belfast person called a shafty, because I've never heard of it, but Colm was convinced it exists.
And for bonfire tourists who want to see a good bonfire later on in the summer...
go to the Bogside.
The Bogside. What's so around about mid-August, mm-hmm. and what will be on the... what will be burnt on those?
I would imagine Israel flags, probably, if they could get some DUP election posters, some Union Jacks. Yeah, it's not great. And it's also not culture. Yeah. As a nationalist, I didn't, or, well, I don't know, as a someone who grew up in a nationalist background, I do not see any part of my culture in burning other people's flags.
Stuff. I will say one thing, which is, what would you say, a slightly twisted benefit. See, these enormous bonfire stacks all over the north, something like 20,000 pallets in each, so going hundreds of feet into the air. And a lot of them had Palestine flags on them, right? Now, the Palestine flags did get burnt.
Yes.
But in terms of visible Palestine flags on the landscape, like to look at it, it just...
A lot of solidarity there.
Yeah, like there's a lot of coverage, you know?
Yeah. Now we'll move on. This is about actually building some more things that people don't want. This story is about the glorious GPO in Dublin, where you could argue that Ireland, as the Republic of Ireland as we know it now, was born in the Easter Rising in 1916. The government have approved plans to redevelop the GPO in O'Connell Street. And people are pissed. People are very pissed. The government backed the plans to redevelop the building and a mixed-use precinct, which would include possible shops, offices. It'll keep the working post office that it has and significant cultural use, which I assume means the museum that's there as well. Now, a lot of people have come out against this. The Irish Times had an editorial about how they thought it was a terrible idea. Sinn Féin held their own 12th of July on Saturday, and they had a protest about this. They have said, you know, that this cannot be allowed to happen, that in other countries, you know, they preserve their history. They do not put shops in a boojum and a donut shop and whatever else in it. And Louise O'Reilly, the TD for Dublin Fingal, said that, you know, we can't trust Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael on this issue. And Sinn Féin are not the only people annoyed about this, but they have been leading the charge. Now, Fine Gael, for their part, James Gagan said the government's intention is that it would be put into a museum and a cultural use. They said that the Sinn Féin are making a mountain out of a molehill here and it's not the building of any political party. He said the GPO is the most important building in the foundation of our state. It's a monument to the heroism of ordinary people in this country. But there are 25 retail units along the Henry Street end of the building because it is absolutely massive. I used to get my hair done, actually, in the GPO arcade. There's a hairdresser's on there.
Just to paint a picture for anyone trying to visualise this. So basically, the GPO is currently like a giant square capital A. Like the top of it is on O'Connell Street.
That's like a birdhouse.
The portico is. And it goes back along Henry Street. And then this kind of unloved street, Princess Street North, which is sort of a loading bay at the moment. And the front of it is the GPO. There's a museum. So that's the O'Connell Street bit.
I've never actually been to that museum. It's not very promoted. Considering, obviously, the GPO is seen as like the birthplace of the country. And I've been to the GPO loads and I actually used the post office in there. I've never been on
the front. The front of the GPO is going to, it's going to give you enough culture anyway. There's always about 15 protests and
a lot of people handing out Jesus leaflets as well.
Right. It's going to tell you about modern Ireland. And then along Henry Street, there's a load of shops. And then a lot of it is unused. And there are offices in it already, probably. Ones with lots of cardboard
boxes. Yeah, and there's the arcade and stuff. Yeah. Now, don't get me wrong. On both sides of this, it's whoever you believe. I already don't think that the GPO is being protected and used the way other countries would do it. You know, we have seen their talk about the redevelopment of Murray Street. And my general feeling is that the inner city, even if it's the birthplace of our country, isn't treated with any respect by successive governments.
Yeah.
And I think in other countries that had revolutions and violent revolutions at that, they preserve these places. I don't really want to see a donut shop in the GPO.
A giant donut, but like the centre of it is like an old artillery shell hole from the gunboats.
Or they could call it Connolly's, but the two O's could be donuts.
Could be donuts, yeah. Was it for this? And then a sign saying, was it for this underneath?
But the Fine Gael TD here actually does make a good point. He said that the government want to make O'Connell Street and the GPO busy again. They want people, you know, they encourage footfall, which I also think we should encourage. O'Connell Street, again, like the rest of the inner city, has been completely neglected. It's incredibly dangerous. And a lot of people are only going over to that end of the street because there's two really good pennies there.
Yeah. Well, maybe pennies should be consulted on this as well. And
I actually think less people would be annoyed if they suggested we're putting the pennies in the GPO. Yeah.
Pennies from heaven. It could be there. Nobody's going to agree, though. For whatever it'll be, they'll hate it. Unless they put a giant library in there and nobody can disagree about a library.
Yeah.
They'll probably complain about the books. Maybe put
even like a community space or something.
Yeah. Put a monument to the Orange Order in there just to
yeah, that'll help tensions, I think. Yeah.
70 years ago, my mother used to go to concerts in around there in 2RN, radio concerts. Because the radio station used, the forerunner to RT used to be based in the GPO.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So the people are saying they should bring it back. Put the radio bit of RTE in there. And I mean, you could have the Liveline Christmas Eve broadcast every day outside. You could actually have Liveline on the street.
But they'd also have to compete with the many soup kitchens in O'Connell Street because the government have also neglected homeless people.
That's a different time of the day. It's fine. Liveline will take the afternoon shift. They can be there with the people telling you about Jesus.
Yeah.
And the people,
the
complaining.
Chinese communist people are also
Falun Gong.
There. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Either way, O'Connell Street needs an
it needs
oomph.
Something. Yeah. Totally agree.
So, Aoife, next story, something like the bonfires and all of that. It always seems like a problem. How do you break the logjam, or how do you change the conversation? This week, we've an example of where actual things can change just through soft power, through conversation away from prying eyes.
That's so true. You will never believe who has had an influence on President of America, Donald Trump, but his lovely wife, Melania. Now, we need to remember actually that Melania is Eastern European herself. She's Slovenian. Melania is probably most well known for the fact that she does not like her husband very publicly. She refuses to kiss him. She refuses to hold his hand.
Maybe she just doesn't like public displays of affection. Maybe she's just very old school in that sense.
Yeah, maybe. I'm going to guess it's a lot more to do with his personality than hers.
Okay.
So Donald Trump believes that Russian leader Vladimir Putin is talking out of both sides of his mouth, is probably the way to put it. If he was from Derry, that's the way he would say it. And
he's
said,
firing missiles out of both sides of his mouth.
Yes. Donald Trump said this week that he had a call with Vladimir. That's what he calls him, Vladimir. And he said he went home and he told his lovely wife, Melania, I had a call with Vladimir Putin. And Melania said, well, that's interesting, because he just fired on another city. So here is the clip of Donald Trump telling people that his wife Melania has had an influence on him.
I go home, I tell the first lady, you know, I spoke with Vladimir today. We had a wonderful conversation. She said, oh, really? Another city was just hit. So it's like, look, he's, I don't want to say he's an assassin, but he's a tough guy. It's been proven over the years. He's fooled a lot of people. He fooled Bush. He fooled a lot of people. He fooled Clinton, Bush. Obama, Biden, he didn't fool me.
So yeah, it appears that the influence of Melania has actually got somewhere, because Donald Trump has said, now, I'm very disappointed in him, but I'm not done with him. He said, we had a deal 4 times, and then you go home and you see he attacked a nursing home in Kyiv. What the hell was all that about? So yeah, what's happening to Donald Trump is that Vladimir Putin, like many men, says one thing to your face and does someone else behind your back. He's not afraid of Trump. And I think Vladimir Putin knows that Trump is quite intimidated by him. And I know we talk every week about Gaza, as we rightly should, and the amount of people that's died and how Israel is conducting, you know, their genocide in Gaza. And because of that, we can only kind of concentrate on one conflict at a time. So Ukraine has fallen by the wayside, considering how taken by the Ukrainian cause Irish people were. So Donald Trump has told Russia that he has 50 days to resolve the war with Ukraine, or he will face new massive economic sanctions.
The 50-day deadline is kind of suspicious, though, because he said that Putin told him he was going to finish it in 60 days, take what he wanted in 60 days. So Trump has given him nearly enough time to do what he wants to do. I find Trump fascinating as a leader because he is as capricious and easily swayed and change his mindy as almost any normal person would be. Like, basically, he reminds me of me in a way. I talk to somebody with a strong opinion and I go, you know what?
Yeah.
Made a good point. And then talk to somebody else with a completely opposite strong opinion and you go, you know what? There are both sides to the story. It's like the football fan and I think it was in the Fast Show, who would just agree with whoever
the last person
sitting.
He spoke to. I actually had a very similar experience when I was at school. We used to have to, in religion, very like Dairy Gardens actually, but we used to have to watch all these like Truth and Reconciliation things about loyalists and IRA members who had like turned their life around and stuff. Yeah. And there was one episode about Michael Stone, famously the loyalist killer who bombed the Mulltown Cemetery. And he was took up painting in prison and he had dedicated his life to art. And I went home and my little 16-year-old self, and I was like, he's really changed. And my dad was like, no, he hasn't. And I was like, no, daddy, he's really changed. Like, he's found God and he does all his painting and, you know, he's turned his life around. I was like, you can't, you know, there was people on both sides and they were young when they joined and we have to give people grace. Not 2 months later, Michael Stone broke into Stormont with a gun and tried to murder Martin McGuinness.
Yeah. 2 months, 2 months.
So I too am like Donald Trump. Yeah. I can be convinced.
16-year-old you, 47-year-old me hasn't changed a bit. But so he, like, his actions only ever make sense if you believe that he is on the side of Russia, like ultimately over the course of, unless this is different.
However,
soft power of Melania has made a difference.
Yeah, well, it's not only that there'll be severe tariffs if they don't get the deal in 50 days, but there are new plans for infusions of weaponry for Ukraine. So a deal under which the NATO military alliance would buy arms from the United States, including anti-missile batteries, will then be distributed to Ukraine to help it battle the Russian invasion. So this would be the first time that Trump has, like, obviously weaponry has gone over before, but Trump is not fussed on giving Ukraine weapons. He's not great sharing, doesn't like sharing stuff, unless it's Israel, and then he'll send them a lot of stuff. But he said it would be billions of dollars of military equipment. It's going to be purchased from the United States, going to NATO, and that's going to be distributed to the battlefield. And this is probably the stick that he's trying to beat Putin with.
The hardest thing to understand when you're watching war happen is that people just negotiate while it's happening.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. Like, you know, this is a strategy to do X, to not win or lose, but to manage a future post-war situation. And people will just be killed along the way. You know, it's like the, you know, who is the last person to die in a war while negotiations are happening? Or people continue doing something right up until a ceasefire? It's so pointless.
It's quite hard to get like full numbers, but just to give people an idea, almost 800,000 Russian soldiers have been killed or injured, and in Ukraine have had 400,000 military killed or injured. Civilian casualties, which is incredibly sad, 652 Russian people have died, and 13,438 Ukrainians have died, and 800,000 people have left Russia, and 9.4 million Ukrainians have been displaced.
Yeah.
So I know people can only concentrate at one thing at one time, but it is absolutely horrific what is happening to the Ukrainian people and the Russian people who have to live under Putin, whether they like it or not. And we know, obviously, that democracy isn't exactly upheld in Russia as well. So hopefully, if Melania Trump can get in Trump's ear anymore.
If we can believe anything that he says.
Like, if we could get a word in Melania's ear, even if she agreed to, like, one dinner a week and maybe, like, a shift, that he might do more for Gaza.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Is there any way we could leverage Melania's affection into stopping war in general?
I don't think her... So her background would say, right, I'm from behind the old Iron Curtain,
yeah,
sort of.
I wouldn't say she's a big fan of Russia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But whether she cares as much about the Middle East is hard to say. But, like, the interesting thing about this is that it's possible for conversations like that to make a difference, or emotion, or tantrums, or...
They do say that the First Lady is an incredibly important political... And we know over, you know, centuries, for Eleanor Roosevelt was basically running the country, Jackie Kennedy, for all the horrendous things JFK put her through, often gave him foreign policy advice. We saw the same with Hillary Clinton. She was absolutely pilloried for her influence on her husband. But it is really important. Everyone needs a confidant. Everybody needs someone even just to complain to at the end of the day. So this is the first time we've ever heard of Melania getting involved in foreign policy. That's right. I think it's interesting that it's to do with Russia and she is from Eastern Europe.
Yeah, because previously any interventions she made were about online bullying. So
yes,
she had a campaign against online bullying. Also, she wore a coat.
Yes, I really don't care.
Do you? And that coat was worn, was that on a visit to the border?
Yeah. Melania Trump's anti-bullying campaign was called Be Best, and it was a speech addressing cyberbullying, married to one of the most powerful cyberbullies on earth.
Maybe she's just trying to tear the system down from the inside.
Yeah. And for our final story, the lads will be delighted. But a sport again, Colm. I've getting you two sport stories in 2 weeks.
Again, it's sport plus nostalgia, the Venn diagram that rules my life. We have, now this recording is on Tuesday, so this is a bicycle race that travels around the mountains and valleys of France.
Tour de France.
Heard a lot, 60 or 70 or sometimes on descents up to 100 kilometres an hour. So trying to predict what will happen on a given day. But as it stands, we have an Irish leader of the Tour de France in the yellow jersey for the first time since 1987. So as the only person involved with this pod who is actually old enough to remember the last time. This is just very personal to me. Well, do you know...
What's a yellow jersey?
The yellow jersey is the jersey that the leader wears.
Oh, so he hasn't won though?
No, it's just the person leading at any given time. So it goes on for 20-something days. And there's a number of jerseys you wear in the Tour de France. There's the yellow one, which is the leader.
Okay.
And if you're still wearing the yellow one,
you win.
At the end, you get to keep it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's kind of like a pass the parcel.
Yeah. Is the Tour de France just a men's race?
There is a Tour de France for women, Tour de France Femme.
Femme.
And
in the club, we all femme.
It is eight stages long. And it goes on in October. So we'll definitely cover that.
I'm
in
sure
October.
You will, all right.
Well, we've got a male.
Yes, who is our yellow jersey?
Our yellow jersey, he is born in Birmingham, but of Irish stock.
Hold the phone. Yeah. He was born in Birmingham.
Yeah.
Does he live in Birmingham?
He's so busy cycling that he's probably lives everywhere.
Is this
Ben Healy? He's the first Irish man in 38 years to wear the yellow jersey. If you're, listen, you of all people.
I'm
when
not going
to
decide
where you're born.
Who is Irish and who isn't after my speech for the 12th.
this is where you draw the line.
Yeah, I want us to get things. If we're going to want things, I want to want things properly.
Properly? Oh, yeah. Proper Irish, man. Well, let's get into that.
No, is he an Englishman who claims to be Irish? Is what I'm saying.
No, he's not. His grandparents were Irish. I think his father was born in England, but I think he was the only one of his siblings, of his father's siblings, to be born in England. So he's Ben Healy from Birmingham. First Irishman in 38 years to wear the yellow jersey. I watched the highlights. You see, like, you won't get this, Eva, because you're not that interested in sport, but watching highlights of a cycle race and becoming emotional on TG Cahir, like learning the Irish. Let me see some words I've learned. Rohr.
Rohr.
Unsee is attack. So that's when the cyclists go really quickly in order to break away from the peloton. Peloton isn't an Irish word. That's a French word. Igdrapa, climbing. I was watching the highlights last night because I'd missed the live thing. But this takes me back to the summers of nothing else being on apart from long-term sporting events. All of the French Open, all of Wimbledon. And after that, then, when Wimbledon was over, you'd switch to Tour de France. And Tour de France from about the 8th of July until the 21st, or 1st of July until the 21st, watching cycling 3 hours a day. And it's just so good for the soul.
Sorry, I didn't realise. So it's like football in the way that you have to like pledge. I've Googled this man now, right? So he was born in England. He has Irish heritage through his granddad. But he, through competitive cycling, opted to pledge his allegiance to Ireland rather than England.
That's right.
So that's why he's an Irishman.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
And also, he just is, all right? But anyway, it's...
I also, just for more info now, I'm on his Wikipedia. He is 24 years old. He is 5'9". We love a short king. They're really having a moment.
5'9" is not short. That's perfectly
average.
He's
a short king, no?
I don't know. Maybe now. But anyway, he's perfect size for...
He's a perfect size for a great ride.
Yeah. He's just... You're missing the point here, Aoife. Yeah, I know. Right. But he, like the last time in Irish, the last person to do it was Stephen Roach, who actually won it.
Oh, yeah, I know that name.
And this takes us back to 1987. Charlie Haughey magically.
Charlie Haughey was in the Tour de
magically
France.
Appearing. So Charlie Haughey had not expressed any interest in bicycles prior to that point. When Stephen Roach getting his final yellow jersey as the winner, Charlie Haughey magically appears on stage to share the glory. And this used to be.
Fantastic. What a man.
Leitmotif, turning up at the pivotal moment of an Irish sporting success, like in Rome in 1990, turning up at the World Cup. This is just the tears are falling from my eyes as I think about the nostalgia.
Thinking about Charlie Haughey.
Yeah. Now there was a fella. Like, complicated. But you knew where you stood with how you didn't know where
like
he stood.
It's like what I always say about Bertie Ahern. Irish people love a politician that they feel like they could go for a pint with. And Charlie Haughey, a man so crooked he would have slept on a spiral staircase, you could go for a pint with him.
I don't think you would. I think we liked him for a different way. I think we liked him because he was the Lord of Kinsealy. And I always like to imagine Charlie Haughey talking to Bertie Ahern about Bertie Ahern's tribunal troubles and Charlie Haughey saying, five figures? What's the problem? My good man, make it a million.
You should try it sometime.
Get into trouble. Exactly. And that's where P. Flynn was like the exact halfway in terms of, you know, the good life between Charlie Haughey and Bertie Ahern. So, yeah, this is why this is good, because then we get to talk about this kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So the cycling victory, as he was third in the stage, Ben Healy. Well done, Ben Healy.
Yeah, well done. When do we find out if he wins? When's it over?
So this is stage 10 or 11, so there's probably another week and a bit. Maybe Sunday week, would that be right? Yeah, Sunday week it finishes, so we'll see. There's a lot of other cyclists involved who would also like to win the race.
Do you get money for winning the Tour de France?
Money isn't great unless you do really well. And the prize for winning the Tour de France is $500,000, which is hard won. Like, that's a lot
Your
of work.
Should be in tatters.
Yeah, like Ronaldo, in his most recent deal with the Saudi Arabian club / the Saudi Arabian National
Government.
Wealth Fund, is, I think, he might be $400,000 a day or something like that. Then, of course, if you Google how much does a professional cyclist earn, you get a sentence which is the salary of a professional cyclist can range from zero, roughly 25% of female riders, to almost 6 million. So it now it's relevant, isn't it? Because of the inherent sexism involved.
Yeah.
But there is a women's Tour de France fam, and that's in October, 8 days. So yeah, they put like of all of the, I think, boxers and cyclists in terms of work put in.
Like podcasting.
Money. Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
It's like a lot of work to make now a lot of money.
Yeah, and the risk of injury in podcasts. Like, I woke up this morning going, oh, it's a podcast. And I twisted my back getting out of bed to do this podcast. And for what? But for now...
A labour of love.
As at this stage, Ben Healy in the yellow jersey. Watch it on TG Cahir and pick up bits of Irish. There's two brilliant commentators on it. I don't have their names. Mm-hmm. But you know when commentators... They don't hide their emotion.
Yeah, like they're quite biased against the Irish.
Absolutely.
For the Irish person.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of them, just as Ben Healy, as it became apparent that he was going to win the yellow jersey, he just went, oh, like that. Just, I like a commentator who just growls from the soul.
Great.
So TG Cahir, for all your Tour de France needs from now until Sunday week.
And
best
then,
luck, Ben Healy.
And then 27th of July, Jamie's won matches. It'll be the All-Ireland football final. Donegal and Kerry, just wanted to give a shout out of my total and complete bias towards Donegal.
Yeah.
And so I think you should probably take on the Kerry element, being from the south of the country.
Oh yeah, it doesn't really work like that. The rivalry. Well, the problem, the most depressing thing for Cork now is we're no longer really seen as rivals to Kerry. In sport, the most depressing thing is not your hated adversary abusing you. It's when they're nice to you.
Yeah, I feel sorry for you.
The level of vitriol on social media between Kerry and Cork has reduced to the point you're kind of feeling irrelevant. But we've got the hurling next week.
Great,
so
I know.
That's well done, what we want to focus on.
And we have more good news. So we have a listener email. This is quite a long one. Good news is also me pushing my dog health agenda. I have never heard of a dog health agenda. My dog Murphy, gave his first donation of blood to the UCD Vet Hospital to be used for emergency blood transfusion. He was the best boy and has come so far since we got him. I like to say he's second hand, but as most people use the term rescue, we'll go with that. Dog blood banks are critically low, and if your dog is healthy, over 25 kilograms, and has a placid temperament, my dog's out, please consider donating. There is no recovery time and it can save a dog's life.
That is something I never knew.
Was it that.
Doggy blood. And did,
also, can I just say, also, if you're able, please donate human blood as well.
Yeah.
We really need human blood.
Yeah, you don't get them mixed up, though. Yeah. I don't think the doggy blood people can take your human blood. I mean, that mix-up is ripe for a kids' TV show where a child
becomes
part dog. Like, Wolf. Do you remember Wolf? Are you too young to remember Wolf?
I remember Wolf. And it's also like, you know the way, like, in Disney, Goofy was a dog and wore clothes and had a girlfriend, but Pluto was just a dog.
Yeah, a Goofy. Goofy also solved the conundrum of how a dog would wear trousers as well, too.
It was on both
hind legs. He had braces. So this is how news gets covered on this podcast. That's brilliant. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I love that. Great email.
Does the dog get a pint at the end of it? Do they get loads of custard
creams? Can I get a wee doggy
treat?
Because you have to get a wee bit of, well, dogs aren't allowed sugar, but I'm sure they have to get some sort of calories under them at the end.
I've donated blood 4 times, shamefully late in life. Do you know what prompted me, right? There was a guy on Twitter said, my wife has a serious life-affecting illness. She still donates blood. Mm. What's stopping the rest of you, see you next Tuesdays, and he used the abbreviated version of it, from donating blood. And I was,
I
felt called out. Sometimes you need the right swear word to be called out in a positive way. So based on that, I can't remember the name of the guy. I contacted him since saying, you caused me to donate blood. So I've donated blood. I think I'm on number 4. It is the most
smug biscuit
you can have. In Dublin, if you go to
Dalier Street,
and it is a beautiful view. So when you're having your tea and biscuits, you're looking out over O'Connell Street, as O'Connell Street is meant to be enjoyed.
Like the emperor.
Exactly. Yeah, like that's where the palace should have been. I mean, I love a republic, but I think Dublin really needed
a palace at some point.
And the great thing about palaces, what they do is you build a palace, then you demolish all the peasants' houses
for
a huge distance around. You get a lovely plaza. Sorry, I'm getting distracted. Donate blood from anywhere. They're very active now. And if you have platelets, give them as well.
Yeah, I haven't been able to because I keep getting tattoos as part of my life crisis anyway. I kept getting tattoos and I can't get
them. Tell us about the snake tattoo.
The snake tattoo was a bet that I lost with my dad, because when I was writing my book about Sinn Féin, they gave me a nickname and the Gaeilge was on Nathair Nava, so the poison snake. And I was crying when I found out about it and I felt like my book was going to be terrible. And my dad said, if your book becomes a bestseller, you'll have to get a tattoo of a poison snake. And I said, yeah, that's fine, because I don't think the book's going to be any good. And it went straight to number 1.
Very good.
Now I've got my little tattoo of my poison snake.
So if I call you something...
Yeah, I don't plan on getting... If I tattooed every nickname that people have given me over the years, it would be quite offensive, I actually think.
Yeah.
And on that note, that's us this week for a few scoops. I hope everybody is having a lovely summer, even though the weather has turned. Happy glorious 12th. Thank you very much to Siobhan, our producer, who puts up with us every week. And please email your good news to afewscoops@goloudnow.com. Colm, anything to add?
No, except good luck Cork and the All-Ireland final next Sunday. We will, in true GA sense, they're favourites, but actually they're terrible. They're not going to win.
They're the underdogs.
Stop making us favourites. They're underdogs. Sure, they have only three Hurleys between them.
Yeah.
It'll be a miracle if they turn up, yeah. If they even get to the pitch, and then we can have that surprise then when they win.
As always, yup, Cork.